Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Drive into almost every town in America, and underneath the Welcome To sign is a sign for the local Rotary Club and where they meet. Drive a little further, and you'll go past the VFW or American Legion. Turn on this program, and there's a good chance you'll hear someone representing an association. These are all organizations that have been very active in their communities and for their members and their causes. But today, many of them are facing a real challenge: fewer people becoming part of the organizations or association. Why is it happening? Joining us on today's program, Steve Grum, Executive Director of the Lancaster Bar Association. Mr. Grum, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is John Cram. He's the past District Governor of Rotary International. Mr. Cram.
Good morning.
And on the phone is Thomas Hanzus. He's the State Commander of the Pennsylvania Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW. Mr. Hanzus, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. That's the number to call. If you would like to make a question or a comment via email, just send something to smarttalk@witf.org. Maybe you can make a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, this feels like, I don't know, traditional Americana, when we're talking about driving into towns and seeing the Rotary sign or the VFWs, or, you know, we all are familiar with county bar associations, state bar associations, that if indeed you are getting fewer members, it just feels like a time is passing. So I'll just ask the broad question, why is this happening?
I'll start with Rotary. First, a minor correction. I was not the district governor of Rotary International. I was the district governor of District 7390, which is seven counties in south central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we were giving you a little more credit.
And I appreciate that, but a lot more smarter people take care of that. Rotary International's international membership has been 1.2 million members for several years. But we're finding that in North America, the membership is declining. The growth is coming in Asia and India and South America. What we're finding locally, and we were talking about this earlier, is that younger people have a view of Rotary as being a bunch of old white guys in dark suits. We are doing a lot to try to overcome that. And of course, that's communication. Rotary is changing many of its quote unquote rules to try to appeal to younger members, which would include alternate meetings, say at a brew pub, Saturday meetings, making families more welcome, and reducing the cost. The whole focus for us, of course, is service in our communities and internationally.
That was one of the things I wanted to get to make sure we explain exactly what your organizations do. Rotary International, Rotary Clubs, as I said, have been very active in public service, but what is your mission?
The mission of Rotary is to do good in the world, whether that be in our communities, be internationally. And we are in over 200 countries, 35,000 clubs, and we're service-oriented. That's just what we do. It can be locally, putting up something as simple as a backstop to a baseball diamond, taking care of, say, a women's shelter if they need, say, kitchen equipment, helping with educational needs, do a lot of scholarships. And internationally, we're talking about establishing clean water sources for the 83% of the world that doesn't have clean water. A big initiative is the elimination of polio in the world. Now, you look like you might have been around to know when polio was in the United States. But in the 1970s, worldwide, there were over 1,000 polio cases a day. And Rotary International saw that and said, we can do something. So far this year, there have been only 5 cases of the wild polio virus, and it's due to the efforts of Rotary, World Health Organization, and other health organizations getting out and immunizing kids.
So, Steve, I'm curious though about the Bar Association. I mean, it's an association. It is something that I assume you have to be an attorney to be part of the Bar Association. I don't know, do you have associate members or anything like that, or do you have to be an attorney?
We do, and strictly speaking, you don't, because we welcome law student members as well. So attorneys in the making. But we're in terms of our mission, Scott. We're about a 700 member professional association based of judges, lawyers, and law students who are in and around Lancaster County. So as of course you'd guess by the name, our focus is much more local. And as with most bar associations, there are two dimensions to the mission. On the one hand, we're serving the legal community, our members. We're doing a lot of primarily educating and training our lawyers so that they can be the best advocates for their clients and the best stewards of the justice system. On the other hand, we're trying to serve the Lancaster community more broadly. So we run a lawyer referral service. We are the publisher of the county's legal periodical where folks would go to post legal ads when they form businesses or they're running the estate of a deceased relative. And then finally, we promote and do a lot of volunteerism or pro bono work. And we also run a charitable foundation through which we raise money and then donate to other nonprofits.
But are you running into the same challenges?
We are. And I suspect it's for similar reasons. On our end, just looking at the age demography, we see a challenge. And so about 38% of our members are 60 years old or over. Our median member age is about 54. And not quite 20% of our members are 35 or younger. So what we're seeing is that the more senior cohort, which is going to be moving into retirement with years and years of experience and expertise and leadership, is much larger than the smaller cohort that is coming in and we're hoping will fill the ranks. And so the question for us is now how do we recruit and, more importantly, retain the millennials and Generation Z attorneys?
But tell me if this is accurate. Yeah. I mean, it's not like there are fewer law students getting into the profession, correct?
The recession threw a little bit of a mix into that calculus because there were smaller graduating law classes for a few years. But in the grander scheme of things, Scott, if you just look at the population demography, it's right to say that there are a whole lot of millennials who are coming in as the boomers are sort of moving into retirement. So it should even out.
But they're deciding not to join the Bar Association?
We're not quite sure yet. It's not so much that they're deciding not to join. I think that they're being a little more discerning now in looking at the value of the Bar Association. And as John said, we were talking about this earlier. The way I've come to think of it is this. Whereas Gen X and certainly boomers would look at association membership and say, you know, I like the mission there. I'll pay in my dues. And I'll find my value. It's an investment for me. Younger lawyers are much more transactional when they look at the possibility of membership. That's not a criticism at all. It's just a different approach to things. They're saying, what specifically would I get for my investment of dollars? And we now have to better identify the value proposition that they're going to get for that. We also have to recognize the fact, I think, and this is a really important needle to thread, that for 25 years now, boomers have quite understandably been molding member associations to suit their needs. And it's possible that millennials and Gen Z lawyers are looking at that mold and saying, well, I recognize it, but it's not going to suit my needs. Now, that's not a knock on the boomers, but it is to say that we need to find a way to encourage the millennials to recognize, you know, it's a member association, so it means that you can come inside the door and start to remold this. But it's not just on them. I think we as I, as an executive, and my board of directors as member leaders, the onus is on us to be able to encourage them to come in and to give them enough incentive to do that.
Let's talk about the VFW. Thomas Hanzus is the state commander of the Pennsylvania Veterans of Foreign Wars. Mr. Hanzus, I have a sense that we're going to hear kind of the same thing from you having to do with demographics and age. Is that accurate?
Yes, yes, it is. That's very accurate. Many of the things that the Rotary and the Bar Association just spoke about will certainly affect us at the Veterans of Foreign Wars also. We have about 71,000 members and about 420 posts throughout the Commonwealth. Much of our demographics and everything are very similar, but most notably would be the age. We have veterans from 20 or less all the way to our World War II veterans, which are 90 and older. So we have a very broad spectrum of veterans that we deal with.
But why aren't they joining? I mean, I would think, because let's face it, there's a real camaraderie amongst veterans, especially those who have fought overseas. Wouldn't an Iraq veteran, Iraq War veteran, or someone who has fought in Afghanistan look at someone, a World War II vet, a Korean vet, Vietnam vet, and, you know, have great respect for them, but say, you know, I want to be one of those people?
Sure, they probably do, but you have to remember that during the Vietnam War, the majority of soldiers that we sent were very young soldiers. Now we're in conflicts all over the world where we're sending Guard and Reserve units who are in their late 20s or 30s who are already raising a family and have difficulty adjusting when they come back and being deployed multiple times. Definitely, they want to try to maybe stay away from anything military-oriented. It's a tough sell sometimes.
And I'm going to ask all three of you this question, but Tom Hanzus, I'll start with you. Why is this important? I mean, we're talking about these associations, organizations that have been mainstays in the community that gaining fewer members. Why is it important that membership continue, the organizations continue the way they are?
Well, it's quite evident that strength comes in numbers. Now, in the Veterans of Foreign Wars, our priorities of legislative advocacy for our veterans, last year we brought in over $30 million in federal benefits to our veterans that earned it. And we look at our veterans to help veterans' families in the communities we live in. They are vital, and we need them and they need us. We have to have the numbers.
So, you know, John, let me go to you and talk about Rotary. Why is it important? Obviously, you've talked about the things that Rotary does. It sounds like it's a success. Well, it has been a success story, but it continues to be a success story internationally. But here in the U.S., where you have fewer members, why is this important?
Well, I think people have a natural propensity to want to serve their communities or provide some sort of service in the world. And Rotary provides an excellent venue to do that. It also provides a venue for business interactions, for the development of fellowship within a community. And these are reasons I've joined. Again, I think it's that urge to want to serve, and Rotary provides that venue. And it has, of course, the mechanisms in place to do that.
But let me ask, are we saying, and I know you probably won't just come right out and say this, but that younger people, meaning age-wise, baby boomers, maybe they just don't want to serve as much?
I don't think that's it. I think it's that they don't want to join much. They're looking for a place to do service, so they might do it through their church. They might do it individually. I know the VFW has service projects in addition to their legislative issues, and we were talking about what the Bar Association does. But I think they want to do something. I think our challenge is to overcome the image that no longer exists, that is, old white guys.
Steve, you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier when you were talking about it, but Has the organization, has the Bar Association changed with the times? And I can ask that question of all of you, but let's talk specifically about the Bar Association, and maybe this represents some other organizations as well, but has the organization changed with the times?
Oh, heck yeah, Scott, is my short answer.
Okay, but do people know, do younger people know that?
I know, and I think that's part of our challenge. Inside our legal community, young lawyers do know that. And we're fortunate that, you know, being a local bar, we do have direct, even physical access to a lot of the young lawyers practicing there. But we still do have a challenge about communicating how the bar is changing to suit the current day needs of more junior lawyers. And so I think it's a matter of the bar evolving at the same time that those needs are evolving, and that in our case, the practice of law is changing too. And that's something that there's no easy answer for this, but it's important to us to try to figure out, as the legal economy changes, what exactly more junior practitioners are going to need from us to be the best lawyers they can be, and then how we can deliver on that.
Give me an example, though, of how you've changed, evolved.
Yeah, sure. So a couple things we're trying to do this way. We're, one, trying to change our education curriculum so that where we used to do a lot of the kind of classic one-hour brown bag education program where a lawyer would come in and they would get one credit hour of what they need to keep their license up for the year. We're now trying to do what we're billing as summit programs, where we're doing multiple credit, shorter blocks of time, maybe a half day, a full day, and we're inviting other professionals from allied professions, whether it's bankers or realtors or folks from the land use community, other government officials. These are people that lawyers interact with all the time in the course of doing their work. And my concern has been that for years, we'd kind of siloed ourselves, just saying, well, we're lawyers, we'll do lawyer education, that's it. But that's not the reality of the practice. So we think that by bringing in all these professionals, we're not just giving our lawyers their credits. We're offering the credit now that the other professions might need by partnering with them. And we're giving them all a chance to meet, interact, and do some business generation right there. Another thing that's important, too, I'm noticing is that a lot of younger lawyers, I think, see their professional lives and their personal lives as maybe a little more of a piece. And so it's figuring out how we can make the Bar Association as flexible as possible for them in that sense. And we're trying to build in wellness programming a lot more than we used to. We're offering yoga now. I'm trying to think about social programs that also have a social impact. So maybe instead of the classic happy hour, next week we're over at TELUS 360 and we're doing a lawyer talent show that's going to be a fundraiser for the Crispus Attucks Community Center. So that kind of stuff.
How about Lancaster Lawyer Hip Hop, something like that?
There you go, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The focus of the program today, the first part of the program today, is associations, organizations, a lot of them that have been very involved in their communities, continue to be very involved in their communities over the past 100, 200 years or so, and many of them having a little bit of a challenge attracting new, younger members. Joining us today, Steve Grum, who is the executive director of the Lancaster Bar Association, John Cram, who is a past district governor at Rotary International. What's the numbers?
7390.
Okay. I know Rotary has a lot of numbers when it comes to your district, so I won't remember that, but you're a past district governor. Thomas Hansis is state commander of the Pennsylvania Veterans of Far Moors, the VFW. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, we're going to go to the phone in just a moment, but there's an email that I think it pretty much parrots what you had said earlier, John. Yvonne says, I had to chuckle when the gentleman from Rotary stated people think we're a bunch of old men in suits, because my first thought as you introduced all three of them was that you stated the problem at the same time. All men, fairly likely in their 60s or more. I can say Steve Grum is not in your 60s unless you are very young looking. Steve is young. Probably none of color, and certainly no women in the top echelon. That's why their numbers are dropping, have dropped, will continue to drop. Where is the diversity? And John, let me address that to you. I mean, because you used the term old white men in suits.
I did, and that is no longer the model. The person who really should have been here today is named Una Martone. Una is our immediate past district governor. And she is the CEO of Leadership Harrisburg. In our particular district, I think we've had 7 or 8 women district governors. That is the person who administers a lot of the funds and helps the clubs out. We have a number of women who have been at the Rotary International Directorship. And then we have our funding mechanism for our service projects, which is the Rotary Foundation, which has women members. Now, we only have about 30% membership who are women. That's wrong. 50% of the world, oddly enough, is women. And we need to up our game on that, and we are trying. As far as color, I don't want to get into numbers, but we don't exclude people because of ethnic background. Or anything, what we're looking for is people who want to serve their community.
Do you have to do a better job, though, of, I don't know, I hate to say recruiting, because it makes it sound like you have to go out and run recruitment campaigns, but do you have to do a better job of attracting people of color, for example?
In my opinion, yes. Same with women. I think our buzzword now is attract people. And we have to sell what we do. We're serving our communities. And, we need people to do that. So it doesn't matter if they're women, what color they are, what race. Religion is not an issue in our organization. We're here to serve our communities and the world.
Tom Hansis, is this problem with VFW as well, that diversity?
I think it's improving. I just was at a recent meeting with all the department commanders from all over the country, and we have, I believe, 8 department commanders who are female veterans right now. Most certainly we have our younger and female veterans starting to take a more active role in our organization. We have to find a way to welcome them into our and make them feel welcome, make them feel important. And also, we have to get outside of our post. Our visibility in our communities, many people don't really realize all that the Veterans of Foreign Wars does in their local community, because we've never tried, as the other people have said, they don't realize what we do. We haven't let them know what we do, and we haven't done a good job of selling what we do. So we have to do a better job of that.
Let's take some phone calls. Heather is in Colonial Park. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, Heather, and I'm Heather from Colonial Park Rotary, and I'm actually in charge of new membership.
Okay.
And I will one day be district governor, just letting you know, John.
Oh, good for you.
The problem we have right now is we're not reaching children young enough. We need to get them when they're in grade school. I didn't know about Rotary until I was 42 years old. And, you know, we need to tell these kids in elementary, middle, or high school more about Rotary. We do Student of the Month and that sort of thing. But you got to start looking 20 years down the road, not just about today.
Well, Heather,
and,
let me
as for diversity, I'm very diverse. So go ahead.
Well, Heather, let me ask you this. When you're talking specifically about Rotary, but does that hold true for many of these public service organizations that we're talking about today? Is it that young people just don't know about it, and maybe what they know about it is those stereotypes that we've been talking about?
I think that's exactly right. Young people don't know about it. You learn about Rotary when you hit a certain level in business and success. That's another thing. People think being in Rotary is really expensive. It really isn't. I can take my little bit of money and add it to 1.2 million people's little bit of money and make a huge impact locally, nationally, and internationally. So I think it's, people think you have to be a certain success rate, and you also have to be a certain age, and we're not hitting the schools early enough.
Thank you very much for your call. Go ahead, Morgan St. John.
And to address Heather's comment, clubs can sponsor what are, in essence, Rotary clubs in college and in high schools. They are formally recognized programs, but it's up to the club to sponsor them, not the district, not Rotary International. And we have a lot of those in our district. Right now, there is an informal organization, Heather, called Early Act. And it's something that a club can do in the grade schools. So that opportunity is there.
And we'll say this, you know, when we're talking about age and demographics in particular, let's face it, historically, there have been some organizations, I'm not saying your organizations, but there have been some organizations that have been male only, some that have not welcomed minorities. So for some organizations, you can understand when they hear association or hear public service organization that they think, you know, if I'm a young black guy, you know, I'm not welcome there, because traditionally and historically, many times that's occurred. Nowadays, I doubt it's legal, but, you know, it's something that it has to be over. That stereotype has to be overcome. Let's go to Gary in Juniata County. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. You know what we do. We've been around since the 1960s. We go back before Milton Schaap, if anybody remembers that name. And the group promotes people coming onto a farm. We have a tremendous amount of people that want to come and stay on a farm, and yet we can't get new farms or any farms, basically, to do this. We are the last group in the country. We were, again, around since the 1960s. There used to be dozens of these across every state that promoted agricultural tourism or farm stays or whatever. So we're called PA Farm Stay. And, again, you would think farms, every farm we hear, dairy's in trouble. Commodities are in trouble. The weather has just crushed some organic farms that are near here as far as the amount of rain last year. Just couldn't stay, you know, afloat because, you know, one – and sometimes you're out of business. And yet here we are with every year our numbers just keep increasing of people that would like to come and stay on a farm. And yet our numbers have just dropped precipitously. And the problem is, you know, we can't get new farms to do this. And like I said, we're the last group. Vermont was last year they folded. And now PA Farms, they were the last group in the country, or at least the you know, statewide, that promotes you know, farm stays, and here it is. Everybody talks about it, and nobody wants to do it. Mm. And oh, I was going to tell you, we're the type of organization that we elect officers every other year. If you don't make a meeting, you're very likely to be elected president. So.
All right, thank you very much for your call. Maybe that's what's keeping people away. But you know, the point that Gary brings up, and I think all three of you have made this same point. And I asked the question about whether younger people just don't want to, okay, not serve is not the right word, but to join. I mean, all your organizations do good things. And as you've explained, why they are important. So why is it that younger people, maybe I'm sitting here thinking, maybe it's because there are so many other options out there that, I mean, we talk about kids for the most part who are not playing sports or playing one sport or doing this or not doing that because they have so many options. Is it the same thing with young adults, maybe, Steve?
First, I can solve that gentleman's problem because we usually appoint the person who doesn't show up at the meeting as the leader. So always a good solution for us.
There are some strategies you can use there.
Yeah. And second, Scott, you know, I suppose we're in a good position there because we're a little different in that we're a unique game in town as the County Bar Association. So our young lawyers are going to come to us, and they're going to at least check us out and see if we're worth investing in. And again, our principal challenge then is when they look at us, they are going to be going line by line saying, you know, where's my quid pro quo? And the most important thing we've got to do is be able to offer them enough value proposition that they're saying, okay, with all my student loans and all the other things I have going on in my life and everything else that's tugging at me, is this worth putting that money down? Am I going to get more back than I'm putting in.
Mm-hmm. Tom Hans, I want to ask you, I mean, because the VFW, the American Legion, even local fire companies, there are a lot of people who become members with you. Yes, they served, but they take advantage of, I don't know, your social activities, being able to get an inexpensive meal, being able to see friends and that kind of thing. I mean, that would seem to be a good reason for people to join and people to be active. But do you, if there's so much emphasis on the social part of it, does the service part of it get left out or get left behind?
Well, I don't believe it gets left behind, but most certainly that's a selling point for our organization. We've taken a proactive approach also on the non-smoking issue. We have about 70 of our posts right now who have gone non-smoking, and we have many posts who have updated their posts and brightened their posts up to make them more up with the times. Our posts are no different than anybody's business. We have to change with the times and update with the times, or we'll get passed by. And we're in the process of trying to do that right now for our new members and welcome our younger and community members and children. I think you hit the nail on the head. Young people, you look at churches and stuff that are successful, you see young children in there, being families taking them. And now we see more and more families taking their children to a VFW that's a non-smoking environment for their children.
We're almost out of time. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I think that this is a good way to just make people aware that something that has been traditional anchors in communities that they're going through some changes right now and do a lot of good work, and maybe it's something to think about. Thomas Hansis is the state commander of the Pennsylvania Veterans of Foreign Wars. John Cram is past district governor here in Central Pennsylvania, Rotary International. What district does your cover? I know you're with the Gettysburg Winery.
I'm with the Gettysburg Club, and I own the Adams County Winery. Am I allowed to say that?
Yes, you are.
Our district is 7390, and if people want to find out how to become a member, just Google District 7390.
Steve Grum is Executive Director of the Lancaster Bar Association. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you,
Scott. Thanks,
Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I want to remind you to go to WITF.org under Smart Talk, and we have a list of some of the upcoming topics and shows that we'll be doing in the future. For example, the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island is on March 28th, but starting Friday, which is March 1st, we're going to be discussing the 40th anniversary, taking some of your stories, how you experienced the TMI accident, talking about media coverage. Just to think about it. Probably the most historic event in Central Pennsylvania over the past 50 years. So we start talking about it on Friday. Some of the other topics that we'll be looking to talk about, you know, it's Charter Day next week here in Pennsylvania, where we commemorate Pennsylvania's charter. We have there's a new book out on William Penn. William Penn, of course, Pennsylvania's founder. We'll be talking about William Penn, and you know, there's a lot you don't know about William Penn. Those are some of the topics that are coming up on future shows here on WITF Smart Talk. Almost a third of the Latino population in York County is living in poverty, compared to less than 9% for the county as a whole. 80% of Latinos in York County earn less than $35,000 a year. Those were a few of the findings of a study conducted by a York College student who is interning with the Arthur J. Gladfelder Institute for Public Policy. His research has been called by some of the most important in recent years. Joining us is that student, Cody Little. Cody Little, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Also, Vinny Canizzaro, who is director of the Arthur J. Gladfelder Institute for Public Policy. Mr. Canizzaro, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so Cody Little, you're in your early 20s. You were a student at York College. You're still
yes,
okay.
Still
going to York College, but you were interning, and this study on Latinos in York County. How did it come about?
Well, it was probably first day interning. We were going over different studies for different interns to work on, and this one kind of landed in my lap. And once I started working on a literature review, looking at what other people have found, I thought it would be super interesting to work through. And then we got to work on the findings.
Why did you think it would be interesting? I mean, you're from Northumberland County, right? I mean, not a large Latino population, I imagine, in Northumberland County. Why did you think this would be interesting?
It was a very small Latino population in my hometown especially. So looking at the different challenges that someone would face just based off of their racial and ethnic groups and different things that they see in their day-to-day lives, and I thought that it's kind of unfair to see certain people going through hardships that others aren't. So getting a better understanding about that to try and help people that are facing problems is, I think it would be important to work on too.
So what were some of I mentioned a couple of them.
I'm going to jump in there real quick.
Go ahead.
So it was also the United Way of York County had come to the Institute and myself back in October 2018. Because we really didn't have a good idea of what was happening. I mean, we can talk to community members and they know what's happening in their lives. We talk to a lot of social organizations and they have some idea of what's going on within the Hispanic and Latinx community in York. But we didn't have that really detailed data to back up those claims.
So, why not? Vinny, I have to say that here we are in 2019, and the Latino population is growing in York County.
Absolutely.
All throughout South Central Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So why has nobody really done a study
on
this?
I don't know. And before the United Way had come to the Institute, I think the last study was done probably 10 or so years before. And just since then,
a lot
has changed. And no one really had... I'm going to plug the Institute for a second, but we're a new organization, so we've been around for coming up on 2 years now, and we're dedicated to doing research, policy analysis, policy development for mostly local policy issues. So we work with nonprofits, government agencies, and so on. And we were really filling a gap that wasn't that was in the community before we came about. So when the Institute started, we were able to then be able to provide these services to organizations in the area that before either were going out to different areas, they were working with colleges that weren't in York County, or they just weren't able to get the research done. Mm. So,
and by the way, Arthur J. Gladfelter, longtime York County, very involved in
absolutely
not just York County causes, but statewide causes, and was a longtime board member here at WYGF.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Cody, what were some of the major findings? I mentioned a couple of them in the introduction, but what were some of the major findings?
Major findings were we saw a lot of barriers through the Hispanic community. Like one was 50% were not employed or not working at the time of the study, 50% of respondents.
50% unemployment rate?
Not working, or like not in the labor force, unemployed, kind of combined.
Okay.
It's not equal to the exact unemployment
rate. Right, because there are a lot of stipulations with unemployment, but 50%.
50% of the respondents. And
okay.
Our surveys were statistically significant for the whole population of the Hispanic Latinx community in York City.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a major finding. And obviously a huge problem. And we looked at different barriers to say that was the number one problem we came up with was finding equal opportunity, employment, good employment also too, that not going to take too long to get there, still worth going to work, getting a good living wage. So we looked at that. That was probably the number one finding. Number two was changing the social service model for delivery for those seeking social services. 90% of the respondents that we got from the survey said that they went and sought social services, and about half of those were related to employment and income. So that's why we would say, number one, the biggest finding would be getting opportunity employment for the Hispanic community.
Why do those barriers exist? Why is it difficult for Latinos, Hispanics in York County to find a job?
One big barrier we looked at was language, and it's not just as simple as saying, you speak Spanish and you speak English, and this is why we can't understand each other. It's also comprehension. So say when someone's going to seek social services, they're receiving information on paper, not fully understanding how to apply and how to do these things, and then they get denied when in fact they would be able to access these services. And so this is like hurting a community in which they're available to receive services, but they're not getting them because they have a language barrier.
And there's a lot of other areas that, that are impacting the community. So we looked at three specific areas. One was well-being and access to resources. The second was community and trust. And then the third was use of social services and your perspective on the use of social services. And I think this idea of community and trust is probably one of the biggest areas and one of the biggest barriers to people actually accessing social services, getting jobs, because you know, some of the findings we had were, 48% of respondents know someone that has been discriminated against based on language. I mean, that's a big number of people living in this community. And all of these, you know, the conglomeration of all of these different barriers leads to this idea of disempowerment, disengagement from the community, and they're just not able to or don't necessarily have the drive or motivation to then go out and be able to find these jobs because they don't feel that they're being included within really the fabric of your county.
When you say discriminated against based on language.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
So it could be, you know, there's a lot of different areas of where discrimination can take place. It could be that, a government official denies them some type of service. It could be that they go to a social service agency and based on language, they're not able to get those services. There's a lot of issues now when we see in hospitals with if they have translators or not and what that looks like. Are you able to get the services that you need? Are you able to effectively understand what's being said? And are you able to effectively communicate with the hospital staff? So it's a lot of different areas that people just feel like that they are not being included within York County as a whole.
But who has the responsibility, though, for breaking down those language barriers? Mm-hmm. I know that the study looked at English as a second language learners, and one of the things you also found was that there were many children who are probably going to school who are translating for their parents. So I guess it comes down to, it's almost like a chicken or egg thing.
Right.
Do the English speakers say, okay, we have to offer this as a, we have to make sure that Spanish speakers are learning the language, or do the Spanish speakers have to say, I have to learn the language?
I would say it's both sides, because we found that three-quarters of respondents wanted to continue their education, and part of that continuing their education had about learning English as a second language. And we also looked at different studies, and Mr. Cannizzaro talked to people in the community, and they felt like that at social services organizations, their staffs weren't filled enough with bilingual staff, so people who could disseminate information into multiple languages.
Even social service agencies that were working with the Hispanic population.
I just mean social service agencies in general.
In general, okay.
Yeah, in
okay.
general. So I feel like it's both sides. And I feel like both sides are willing and able to meet in the middle and say Hispanic people are going to learn more English because they want to. They want to get these better jobs. And it's like the statistics from the study show that they agree. We want to have better educational training. We want to have better job training. So they're willing. Social services organizations are also willing to hire more staff that are bilingual to meet in the middle. So that's, I would say, it's both.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times these organizations and when these types of studies and recommendations come out, oftentimes we'll say, well, you know, you need to learn English. We took a different route in saying that the community needs to learn Spanish because it's on all of us to be a more welcoming community. And we're not going to do that by forcing people that to learn a language that I mean, it's difficult to learn a language that I think as anyone can know. And expecting someone to, if they're going to be coming here from a different country, if they were born here but don't have the English language skills that and may be expected them in other jobs. It's a lot to be able to expect someone to learn and then also be able to get by. So we took the idea that to be more welcoming as a community by offering more Spanish language courses, we as general, York County, are going to be able to meet the needs of people living in the county. With that being said, there's a lot of issues that people are still having with translators. I know you brought up with children that, you know, they don't necessarily trust translators that they're speaking with. So they could be saying things that are inappropriate. They could maybe not be translating in an exact manner. So if we're able to train more staff people at social service organizations within the general community to be able to have those one-on-one conversations, it's going to increase the well-being of York County as a whole.
Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in, our guest today, Cody Little, he's a York College student who interned with the Arthur J. Gladfelter Institute for Public Policy and was very instrumental in the York County Hispanic and Latinx, Latinx, I guess I'm pronouncing that correctly, Latinx community assessment. A lot to learn there. We've learned a lot about York County. Also, Vinnie Canizzaro, who is director of the Gladfelter Institute for Public Policy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, you know, Vinny, let me address this to you. Said right at the very beginning of the program that this research has been called some of the most important in York County in a long, long time. Why is it so important? Why is it important that people understand what is going on with the Hispanic population in York County?
So, I mean, within the county as a whole, the Hispanic and Latinx population makes up about 7%. Within York City, it's a little over 30%. So when we're trying to figure out what is going to really propel our community forward, this is a large portion of York County that is being detrimentally impacted. You know, when we're speaking with community members, you know, within the Hispanic and Latinx community, they'll often say that the community is very insulated. You know, they don't necessarily like people from the outside coming in and, you know, trying to change things up. And that's totally understandable, and I can agree with that. But what that means is that a lot of our nonprofit leaders, community leaders, government leaders didn't have an idea of what was actually happening on the ground. They didn't understand what was going on within the lives of a good chunk of York County. So when we were able to put out this research, we're then able to offer really a glimpse into what is going on, what is the well-being within the Hispanic and Latinx community, within people's lives, that then, you know, different public policies, organizations can then begin to figure out what can we do? You know, should we be changing our models? Should we be changing our funding streams? What types of policies should we be putting into place that is going to have really a beneficial impact upon this community that we just haven't been able to really dive into before?
Mm-hmm. Take a phone call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott. Grinch here. I'm sorry, but I disagree completely with what's being said. This is the only country in the world where we have a group of people coming in and they're not required to learn the language of the country, i.e. English. In all of the world, everybody else is learning English. The Spanish people that come here are not too stupid. They can learn English just as well. Broken English, perhaps, but they can learn English. Und auch, überall. Warum können wir mehr Deutschsprache haben in dieser Gegend?
I assume that's Pennsylvania Dutch.
It's German. German. And what I said is, and overall, why can't we have more German speaking here then? And there is a problem with the Vietnamese. Some of the Vietnamese have difficulty, but, oh, well, there's not enough of them to make an exception. There shouldn't be any exceptions made. You come, you learn English.
All right, Bill, thank you very much for your call. I kind of anticipated a call.
I did too.
Because I knew there would be some thinking like that. But the point he makes, when you said, Vinny, that he used the word onus, why is the onus on the native people, mm-hmm. the people who are living in York County, the English-speaking people, to learn Spanish rather than vice versa?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's really an onus on anyone. I wouldn't say that there's an onus on people to learn Spanish or people to learn English. I mean, there are federal guidelines and federal regulations that say that within certain situations, you need to offer translation assistance. Before I was working for the college, I worked for Hopkins Hospital. And that was one of the issues that we were working on, our translation services. So, I mean, there are expecting people to learn Spanish or learn English. I mean, maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. But being able to make people comfortable and being able to speak in their own, their native language, I think is something that we can all agree upon. I wouldn't expect anyone to say, you know, if I'm going to be going to XYZ country, I need to learn that language, especially, you know, because it is difficult to learn language. And I appreciate the caller and calling in. I'll also say that, I mean, English is not the official language of the U.S., so by saying that everyone needs to speak English, I mean, it's a...
Yeah, making English the official language would be a whole other show.
It would, absolutely. It would
be
yeah.
a whole other show.
Yeah.
But I, the point he is making is that it's mostly an English-speaking...
Sure.
And, again, I don't think Bill is coming at it from a racist point of view.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely.
Anything like that.
Yeah.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you both for being with us today. So, Cody, how are you hoping that this research is being used, will be used?
Well, the purpose of the Institute is to forge socioeconomic change and to break down barriers such as inequality in New York City, New York County especially. So hopefully going forward, the research will be used to do exactly that and make some real change. Help out the people in these communities that are disempowered and disengaged. And
any plans to follow up on this to see if there have been some changes made as a result of this?
If there's funding, we because we work with organizations, I mean, a lot of our research is funded by other groups. So, I mean, if anyone out there would like to get research done, please contact the Institute. You can email us at publicpolicy@ycp.edu. And, I mean, we're more than happy to work on, you know, various topics related to inequalities and socioeconomic mobility.
Vinny Canizeros, director of the Arthur J. Gladfelder Institute for Public Policy. Cody Little, your college student who interned and did a lot of this research. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about what's going on at the state capitol with WITF's state capitol correspondent, or I should say state capitol bureau chief Katie Meyer. That's tomorrow's program.